Hoi, chummers. Welcome to the Hidden Grid, your source for all things Shadowrun in a podcast. Sorry this one took a bit to crack, but the Megas are trying to cut my ice, so I had to make things a bit tougher than normal. If they back off, I might be able to post it with a little less encryption. Well, listen up as I bring you up to speed on the sprawling world for just 43 minutes. For those of you living so far in the cracks, big news. The novel line is back with releases supposedly to start in the first quarter of 2009. At least that's what I've heard. Also, the Quick Start Rules just got nominated for an Annie. Best of luck. They're going up against Paizo's Pathfinder RPG Alpha playtest. So, people, get out there, vote, and vote early. I know I will. And finally, for today, is the Shadowrun Missions Character Creation and Transfer Guide. It is up and free to get started on making or transferring those characters from the previous two seasons of Shadowrun's Missions. And that is the end of those little bites. Now, we're going to run a promo.
On tour with a regular traveler. The Roman Colosseum was begun in 80 BC during the reign of Emperor Vespasian at the height of the empire. It could hold 50,000 spectators, which could be shuffled in or out as efficiently as in modern stadiums. A wooden floor covered a network of tunnels, hiding gladiators and animals before it was their turn to fight to the death in the grand arena. On tour with the Gamer Traveler. The Roman Colosseum was begun in 80 BC during the reign of Emperor Vespasian, who was an 18th level fighter. It could hold 50,000 spectators, which could be shuffled in or out at a rate of between 15 to 20 per round. A wooden floor covered a dungeon crawl, hiding gladiators and animals before it was their turn to roll for initiative in the Grand Arena. The Gamer Traveler podcast combines gaming and travel all in one. In each episode, we feature a location around the world, learn about its history and travel appeal, and then find ways to use it in your games. We also have sound scene tours and interviews with other gamer travelers. Learn more by visiting thegamertraveler.com, where you can see the show notes, subscribe to the podcast, and post in the forums. The Gamer Traveler Podcast, because our world is the best campaign setting. thegamertraveler.com.
Now for our main topic. How to get a campaign started. Now, these are the things that I do before I get started. I usually sit down with a pad of paper and a pen or pencil, and I do a lot of brainstorming. Once I'm done with my brainstorming, then I start with what I refer to as the overstory. Then I worry about things like episode creation, and then I worry about statting out the NPCs and everyone else. So, when you're brainstorming, these are the things that I do. The first thing that I think about, actually, is the villain. And the big overarching villain at that. What is it that makes a good villain, and what is it that makes a bad villain? Good villains actually come a lot from those that you can empathize with. I know it sounds kind of hokey. Either there's just something not quite right about the person that makes them become this horrible villain. And why are they the villain of the PCs? That's something else that you're going to have to work out. A lot of this comes in the brainstorming phase. I use a lot of bubble techniques, drawing bubbles, drawing lines out with associated words and phrases. What I'll do is I'll put up a link on the show notes to a brainstorming session on how to create a villain. So, next, after I've worried about the villain, because the villain is actually the most integral part to any long-running campaign, aside from the PCs, of course, is the city and or cities that you're going to run in. That is a big thing, especially in Shadowrun. You can literally globe hop from in between sessions. You can also be doing it in the same session. You may need to go to three different cities. If you're doing that, your arc is really big and you're affecting things on a global scale at that point, which is a lot different. I'm going to worry mostly about small one-city ideas. So the things that you want to think about, like, what city do you want to run this in? Now, when you think about that city, you're also going to have to think about what the hell is it going to look like in 63 years, which is, it's going to look a lot different than it does now. Look at what they've done to Chicago. They've blown up the Sears Tower. They've set off a nuclear device in the middle of the city. These are all things that have lasting effect on a city. So you want to think about those things as far as benefits and drawbacks that those have. With having those benefits and drawbacks for your city, you kind of want to do the same thing as you're going to do with a villain. And you really want to, you know, start wording out using bubbles with lines. It's an old brainstorming technique that I learned in high school that I still use today. How weird is that? So, next, after I'm done worrying about both the villain and the city that I want to set this in, then I start thinking about the characters. Now, the reason that I start thinking about the characters is, well, you need to know what they're going to do. The types of characters that your players most likely play. Usually what happens is you have players that play specific types because they're either A, very, very good at it, or B, they feel very comfortable playing in those. So, this is what you want to think about. You want to think about the group dynamic as a whole, how the characters interact as a group. Also think about every individual character. Try to find reasons for one character to know another character, and build almost like a social web of either favors, or it could be not just favors, but things like, well, I saved his sister, or we grew up in the same block. Find ways of tying characters together into a group and why they would stick together. Because if you don't, you're going to end up with, you know, you meet at the bar. Not exactly something new, and it sounds very much like old school D&D. I personally don't want to do it like that. So I try to think of ways interesting to tie characters together. Now, the fourth thing that I really kind of worry about, and this really takes up the biggest majority of the last part of your brainstorming that you're going to be doing, and that is, you want to think about the players themselves. Now, you think about the players just like you would with characters, because certain players have strengths and weaknesses. Play on them. If a player is really good at melee combat, and you're not, or you have a guy that's really good with magic system, and you're only kind of okay with it, tap those resources. Players are there to have just as much fun. If they don't help contribute, then what are they getting out of it? You need some player buy-in. If you can help create that state of want that players really get, where they want to be integrally involved and they want to feel like they help, a great way to do that is through using nothing more than play up their strengths. And call on them. If you've got a question and you don't feel like digging through the book to find an answer, ask someone. Or make it up on the fly. That's what I do most of the time. And then whenever we have a break or something like that, then I'll go back and I'll say, you know, okay, these were the rules that I just did on the fly. Oh, well, you know, I could have done this a little better by doing this instead. Most of the time, my players don't generally give me too much hassle about making up rules on the fly. Other people get, you've got like a rules lawyer or two in your group, so, you know, those are roles to think of as well. You know, the rules lawyer, the drama queens. Think about the players like that. I heard a really interesting thing on another podcast, and I can't quite remember. I'm going to look it up and put it in the show notes. It was ways of thinking about your players as members of a reality show. It was a great little segment that they did. But I'll find that and put it in the show notes with a link. Now, once your brainstorming is actually finally finished, which, for the most part, that's the part that's going to take your most of your time, is going to be nothing but brainstorming. So, once your brainstorming is over, then what I do is I worry about what I call the overstory. Now, this is how the story that I want to tell either will or will not affect the meta plot that's going on in the game world. Some people don't use a meta plot. I tend to stick with the previous incarnations of the meta plot. I find it interesting. Not everybody does. But this is also where I develop the plot as a whole. What I usually do is I'll develop several plots at once and figure out how they'll all affect the game world. Now, once I have, say, 3 or 4, I'll generally pitch them to all of my players. What I'm looking for is I'm looking for any interest that they may have. Usually what I do is I'll have, a paragraph or 2 paragraphs on each plot. Now what I do is I'll custom cherry pick the description out in a short blurb, 1 sentence if I can manage it. Basically, it's just enough to give them a hook, but not much meat. I like to refer to it as more of spraying the hook with blood and let the sharks bite the metal. Because then once you get them hooked, you can drag them wherever you want them to go. And that leads to some really interesting characters and story development. Now, once you get your general plot line laid out, then what you're going to want to do is you're going to want to actually do sections. This is what I have quaintly referred to as the episode creation. For this, I only try to script out, on the absolute outside, 5 or 6 scenes to a game session. Any more than that, and you're really just trying to do all of it at once. There isn't a need, and you don't want to. I try not to get too far ahead of what my players can reasonably do in one night. The reason is then what I do is I take the things that they've done. At that point, then I'll customize the plot to make it fit more in the direction that it's already going. Now, sometimes you'll script out only 2 or 3 sessions, 2 or 3 scenes, because you think that's all that you're going to be able to have time for. And, they rip through it in 15, 20 minutes. Generally, stop. Don't keep going, because you don't have a plan. All you're doing, you've got your big overarching story plot. You could do several things. You can stop, which is generally what I do, because then that gives me time to figure out how I want the plot to move for the next week with what they've done. And it could be, something as simple as the bad guys don't know anything's going on because the players moved so quick. To, while the players were doing something, the villain was doing something else that then is going to change how something later in the storyline might work. And I don't see anything wrong with doing those sorts of things. No. If you guys decide to call it for the night, find something else to do. Hang out, watch a movie. Remember, this is all a social encounter for everybody. You're supposed to be getting together. Look at me. Social encounter. You're doing this because these are your friends, or at least people that you share something fairly common with. If you finish early, maybe go out and see a movie if you've got time, or rent a movie, or Netflix a movie, just something. Get out there and do something with your friends, or play a board game. Hell, I know that sounds kind of lame coming from an RPG podcast, but if you finish and you don't have anything else planned, and you don't want to try to continue the storyline, do something else. Hell, hang out and just shoot the crap for the rest of the night. Catch up. sometimes that's the best thing to do. But, you know, that's for another episode. That's my little rant. Now, the last segment is what I refer to as statting out. It's statting out your NPCs and anything else. Villains, whatnot. I do really short stat blocks for everyone. Even the big bad guys. I don't put everything. If you need to be flexible, then this is the place where the GM can get stuck. Especially if everything is written down and this is all that there is. If you do that, you're asking for trouble sometimes. Say your bad guy has a rocket launcher because you thought it would be awesome and dramatic, and instead it's completely destroying your plot. Make him lose it, or he never had it in the first place. Because instead of using a rocket launcher, he's actually able to shoot these guys. You know, you don't have to use the rocket launcher. Or if the players get a hold of a rocket launcher. If your players get a hold of a rocket launcher, sometimes that can be outrageously destructive to the plot line. Because they're doing property damage and, you know, massive collateral damage that isn't necessary. That's why if you use just the most bare bones, that generally is what I use. I try to put together, you know, real short stat blocks, not a lot in the way of character, gear, or anything like that. I generally tend to fly a lot of that by the seat of my pants. Now, just because that's the way I do it, that's not always the best way. It's not the only way. Others have to have everything written down. You know, like I say, to each their own. I'm going to give you guys what I use, what I do. Now, if you want me to talk about some of the other things, I can do that too. But, you know, or what I would use when I used to run Dungeons & Dragons all the time. I had to have everything written out. But since I don't run it as much anymore, I tend to do things differently. Now, what I recently started doing is figuring out the social maps for your NPCs. And man, has this helped keep things flowing in my head. Also, the use of flowcharts will help you in plotting the storyline that you're trying to tell. You know, if the players do this, then, you know, this path or this path. I mean, it's pretty easy. There's several free flowchart programs out there. I'll see if I can't find a few and put some links in the show notes. So, see if that helps. Now, with these four things, that's going to really start putting you in the right direction. And that is the end of our main topic. Now, I'm going to do a couple of other things. I want to put out a short topic, probably no more than 2 or 3 minutes. What this is going to do is it's going to allow us to have 2 topics per show, plus a review. Now, this is going to be a fairly long episode because I've got coming up a review on the main rule book. So, that's going to be a long one. So, one of the short topics that we're going to talk about, I figured today, since we're talking about campaigns and getting campaigns started, we would do running published adventures, the pros and cons. Now, this is only what I could write down as fast as I could write this. So, I want to leave this for either another episode or, you know, hear some feedback on what you think. These are what I personally see as the pros and cons of running published adventures. Now, quickly, the pros. You only have to read it 2 or 3 times at the most. All of your plot is right there. They've already done your figuring into the big overplot and how things are going to fit. And you don't have work really to do on it. All of the NPCs are statted. All of your work is done. All you have to do is read it and ad-lib a little bit. So, the cons. Sometimes you're going to have to shoehorn it into the existing campaign that you're running. and that can be a bitch. If you have to shoehorn it, don't use it. Or if you are going to shoehorn it, use it as a side adventure, something that happens while something bigger is going on somewhere else in the game. Con number two, most of the plots in published adventures are linear. It's how they make them. Linear plots are great. They tell you go from point A to point B, get, you know, object C, go to obstacle D, overcome obstacle D, find conclusion E. It's very easy, but at the same time, you're going to have to be a little creative because not everybody gets all the clues. You may have to make some jumps and do things that you wouldn't normally do. Now, the last con is sometimes you're still going to have to scale an adventure. Most adventures are made for newer beginning characters. Now, if you've been playing for 5 years, then you're not using the typical group of characters that they're expecting. So, you're not going to be able to use, you know, Joe the security guard. You're going to need to amp it up, and you're going to need to amp it up a lot. That is a big problem with published adventures, because they're usually made around a power level. If you like the story that's being told, then you may need to do some work on it. Now, that is the end of the two topics. Now, the second topic, I know, can take an entire episode or two just on the pros and cons of running adventures that somebody else has written. I don't want to do any more right now. Maybe if you guys are really interested in it, maybe I'll come back and do something on it. But until then, not happy. So what we're going to do is we're going to take a break now. We're going to run a promo. And when I'm done with that, we're going to come back with a review of the 4th edition Shadowrun book.
Hi, this is Ross Payton, one of the hosts of Roleplaying Public Radio.
And I'm Tom Church, the other guy.
Yeah, we do a regularly updated podcast on RPGs. We do at least 2 episodes a month. We offer commentary, comedy, and actual play.
And occasional and inane stuff no one cares about, too.
Exactly. Our commentary, each episode focuses on a gaming topic, such as how to deal with large groups or horrible gamers, or how to make old games new and exciting again. Our comedy offers such stories as the Law and Orcdom, a fantasy D&D version of Law and Order, and our actual play does games such as Call of Cthulhu, the end of the world as we know it. So if you're interested in any of that, give us a try.
And if you're interested in inane stuff, give that a try too.
Yeah, Roleplaying Public Radio, slangdesign.com/RPPR.
And now, back with our review of the 4th edition Shadowrun book. Shadowrun 4th edition by Catalyst Games Lab, 5th printing of the book, the first printing by Catalyst Games Labs. Okay, folks, so one of the things that I want to do is I want to do a review of every book that Catalyst Games and FanPro has done for 4th edition, because I personally believe this is the best edition that's ever come out. So, with that being said, I'm going to start at the beginning, and I'm going to just work my way through every episode. We're going to review one object, or item, or whatever they give us. If a new book comes out, I'll try to do that. Even though the newest book that just came out is unwired, at least as a PDF, and I don't have it. The review for the Shadowrun 4th edition rulebook. The cover art is nice. It sets a good feel for the game and the world it's set in. The binding is higher quality than most. I personally had a notebook shoved in my copy, and the pages held together. The binding didn't pull apart. I was completely amazed. The fiction in this book has been wonderful and insightful for the world. It has helped to set the stage for the way the world setting works. Amazingly, this book, like most of the main Shadowrun rulebooks, has a wonderful index and table of contents. This book in particular has a 3-page table of contents and a 5-page index. This is something not seen in most rule books in the industry. I liked the fact that they thanked all the people that had ever worked on Shadowrun in the past to make such a great game and for making it the game it is today. Now, with those things said, we're going to go into this chapter by chapter because it's just easier this way. So, we'll start out with the chapter Welcome to the Shadows. Now, this chapter did a lot to set up the setting. It helped get the players and GMs to hit the ground running with the setting. As always, the history chapter is great and full of ideas for playing the game in the recent past all the way to the present. Now, there were some Easter eggs in there for those runners from the distant past. Now, I would have liked to have had some side or timeline sidebars, kind of like they did in the third edition version of it. It helped to make some of it a little cleaner. But other than that, I thought the chapter was pretty nice. Life on the Edge. I personally think that this chapter could have been combined with Welcome to the Shadows. The two chapters pretty much go hand in hand, getting the setting together. Splitting in the middle of the history felt a little jarring. The game concepts and of dice pools is much like the White Wolf Storyteller system. Now, these two systems have fed off of each other back and forth almost from the beginning. And if you ask anybody from the old days of Shadowrun and the old days of White Wolf, they'll openly admit to this being pretty much the case. Now, on to the next. Character generation. Character generation is point buy. No more priorities for two editions now. Too bad. I really kind of liked the idea of that. They helped to make for a little faster character generation. Point buy takes time. Lots of time. And when you start adding in multiple books, it can take the better part of 2 or 3 hours to do a character, and even longer for new players. Yes, that's right. 2 or 3 hours for a standard player to come up with a character. I've seen new players sit there for 4.5, 5 hours working on a character. It's tough as a GM to sit there and watch them struggle through this. There are a few freeware programs out there for 4th edition character generation. I'll put some links in the show notes for those. Now, there is one thing that is very important to remember, and this is a very important upside to all of this, is that characters are highly customizable. It's amazing how customizable they are. Points can also buy qualities. Positive cost points and negatives give you points. Now, that's pretty much the way 3rd edition ran it too. I really like the positive and negative qualities. Condition monitors have undergone some pretty radical changes. Now condition monitors make more sense. Tough characters can take more of a beating while the weaker can't. Now this applies to both mental and physical characters, because your stun is now based on your willpower and your physical is based on your stamina. If he's got a lot of mental strength, he can take a lot of a beating mentally before he starts to, you know, collapse. Now, a couple of things that I do wish that they had done is they had had more of an emphasis on the backgrounds for characters before you start building them. But as usual, Shadowrun characters are generally defined by how good they shoot guns and whatnot, not the strength of the character. I really must admit, I wish the pre-gen characters in the book had been a little less combat-heavy. 7 of the 16 were combat characters, with the rest of them being broken down like this. There were 2 shamans, 2 rigger types, 1 of each rigger type in particular, so there was a vehicle rigger and a drone rigger. And you had a technomancer, which is something new, and they only included 1 of those. You had a hacker, and you had 2 mages, 1 of which is a combat mage. And you had a face. Maybe doing some pre-gen is not the way to go. Maybe giving some ideas of the types of characters, I think, might have been a little bit nicer. I think the pre-gens are just kind of a holdover because most game systems nowadays don't even use them, so there's no point in them. So, on to the next chapter. Skills. Well, not much change in this department. A few new things. I really like now how the skill ratings have an actual table that helps you put things into perspective. Your max skill rating is nice because now no more buckets of dice to do something. That's one thing from the older editions I don't miss. Next is skill groups. All I can say is about time. It really makes sense. I do like in character gen that no character can start at the top. It was high time that changed. Some of the skill rules feel very intuitive, like defaulting and attribute-only tests. As a GM, I can really see using attribute-only tests as a really great equalizer across the board for characters and NPCs, anyway. Next is the combat section. Well, combat in earlier editions of Shadowrun went on forever. Now things end a lot faster. The big initiative changes that happened in 3rd edition pretty much carried straight over. Thank the spirits for that one. Before, it was just crazy. When you had a Street Sam that was pulling 4 attacks before your mage or your shaman got a spell off. Kind of ridiculous. The modifiers tables really feel clean, and there's not a lot of extraneous modifiers and things of that nature. The nice combat summary blocks make it so if you've played Shadowrun for more than this edition, or for any length of time, then you really don't need to spend a lot of time reading these sections. Pretty much cursory overviews will get you through it. Now, there's a few things. I still don't like the grenade rules. They still leave a bad taste in my mouth. Well, that's not entirely true. Really, it's the scatter rules that I don't like. Several things got some nice things. Shotguns got some much-needed love. They finally have been brought into the, 21st century. Melee got some nice cleanup in this book. Defense is now a big thing, not how much armor can I cram on my body. That's been a long time in the coming, and I'm really glad to see that that's happened. Damage is now scary. It feels a lot darker than before. One thing I feel is always an afterthought is vehicle combat. It's never really been given its due till some rigor book comes out, and sometimes not even then. Next chapter, the magic chapter. Magic has really gone under the knife here. Things that needed to be trimmed, got it. Things that needed pumping, got them. There were some really neat and intuitive ideas that came out of the magic chapter this time. I really do like that there's a lot of room to customize the magic system. Before, there really wasn't. Things like making your own traditions are now part of the core rules, which makes it very interesting and it's so customizable it's not even funny. You can make your own traditions now. Also, all the magicians, all magic types, as long as you have the summonings, you can actually summon short-duration astral entities, and you can do long-term bindings. All you have to do is have the right skills. Initiative being included in the core is a nice carryover. That was something that was started in 3rd edition and it's carried over. I really like that. The number of mentor spirits, or as us old fogies remember them, totems. It's nice. It beats the 10 or less in the previous editions. And I just have to say hooray to the bringing back of 3 great old school spells. I'm looking at you, Toxic Wave, Petrify, and of course the number 1, Turn to Goo. That was one of my favorites of all time. I remember creating the stats for it for pretty much every edition, so it's good to see you back, and good to see some new things in there too. Now, on to the painful ones. Hacking. Hacking has always been a pain. This time at least, though, they tried to make it more important that hackers be with the characters in the team. I think the comlink is a really nice idea, but I think it's still tough to execute. They're a lot more like real-world computers. Now, for some of us, that's not a problem. For me, I'm not overly computer savvy, so it seems a little hard for me to wrap my mind around at times. I liked the fact that before it was completely artificial, and if somebody, you know, well, I can overclock my CPU to do this and this, well, you know, whatever. Now you can, theoretically, you can do those things with your comlink. The whole networks thing can be confusing if someone has spent a lot of time with the older editions, simply because the old versions of the Matrix didn't have things like networks that you logged into. It was nodes. Now, you and I all know that a node is pretty much, a string of nodes is pretty much the same thing as a network. Just a different way of talking about them. That's partly why. Takes a little bit of getting used to. Signal strength and other rigor concepts being ported into the hacking rules is different. I'm not sure exactly how I feel about that. One of the big things that I have is the idea of hacking cyberware. I find that to be a bit much. It's a little too crazy for me. I don't like that rigging is included here as well. So for rigging, you have information split in at least two places, not including gear, because you have rigging here, you have rigging in the combat section under vehicle combat, and then they talk about rigging in a couple of other places. So it's, I really wish they would just make a rigger chapter and combine it all in one place so that we can find it. Running the Shadows. There's pretty much nothing for players in here. This chapter is your GM toolbox. It's great for running games. I think having more than just healing and karma works as a great asset. Though this and the chapter Life on the Edge could have been compiled differently to make for slightly more robust chapters. As I said earlier, Life on the Edge and Timeline chapters could have been kind of worked together in a very interesting way, and I think that would have made for two fairly robust chapters instead of three skimpy chapters. Next, Friends and Foes. This is pretty much your standard fare for NPCs and critters, contacts and critters. At some point, I think it would be nice to have an idea segment on, you know, working out new paranormals, because pretty much there have been two books, and both have been out of print for years. Maybe something new in this arena might have been nice. Or maybe a new book, Critters of North America. Flower and Fauna or something, I don't know. Street gear. For the most part, a rehashing of the gear section from past editions. Now, there were only a few truly new toys here. One of the nice features, though, is that there is a lot of artwork in here. For so much of the gear, it really helps to envision the look of a character or an NPC. Now, as a general overall, the cover art is sharp. It really does help set the mood for the setting. The binding is high quality. The interior art is hit and miss. Some really gets high marks and other pieces are kind of lackluster. The interior pages have this really cool green matrixy feel to it. But the front cover logo is all these really cool blues and grays. It feels a little bit out of place with the bulk of the color scheme. I wish there had been a city setting built in. There wasn't any cities in here. Anything would have been nice, just a short chapter even. Instead, they make you wait for Runner's Havens, which is a good book, mind you, but you still have to wait. I would say overall that I would give this book 4.75 bullets out of 5. What keeps this from getting all 5 is organization, which is a big problem for RPGs and has been for years. Now, I just guess I figured a game that was in its teens would be able to look back and see where things could have been worked out a little better organization-wise. But the ability to print out your table of contents and index goes to making things better. I mean, you can have those pages and, you know, just flip to what you need. They work really well. Now, I cannot say how much I really do like this book. It is so much better than some of the earlier versions. The play is so much nicer. So, enjoy the game. Run out and buy it. Oh, wait. most of you better have it already. And if you don't, get out there and buy it. Next, what we normally are going to do is we're going to have one or two websites that we find useful for any number of things, from character ideas to NPC ideas to city locations, anything and everything that I can scour the web for that we might be able to find some use for. I'm going to list off, and it's going to be pretty much a list. Now, the list is going to have, I'm going to do a link list, or I'm considering doing a link wiki to help put things together so that people can just come there and everything will be in one location. Now, because I'm running behind, and, you know, when you're running behind, you forget to do things like that. So, I'm not going to bore you all with any of that. Instead, we're going to jump right to our outro, which includes mostly our contact information, which you can visit us on the web at www.hiddengrid.com. You can email us at hiddengrid@gmail.com. We have a voicemail line where you can call and leave us messages, and I will play those on the air. And that number is 206-666-4881. You can leave comments on our blog, which is at hiddengrid.com/blog. You can Skype the user ZenDead if I'm online. You can follow us on Twitter at hiddengrid. We also have a live journal with the username hiddengrid. And the MySpace address is myspace.com/zendead. Now, there's a lot of ways to contact us, so please feel free. Hidden Grid is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives Works 3.0 U.S. license. Remember, folks, there are many proverbs in the shadows. The most important ones: conserve ammo, shoot straight, and never, ever deal with a dragon.